We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future, on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is November 29, 2015. After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. This week we are live. Got a very interesting show for you here tonight, and this is how it's going to be done. We're going to open up with the usual news segment here on the show, and then we are going to be joined by a very special guest tonight. Francis Hill is going to be joining us here on the show today. Francis Hill is the author of 4 nonfiction books on the Salem Witch Trials, including the widely acclaimed A Delusion of Satan, published in hardback by Doubleday, paperback by DeCapo. You can grab this book on Amazon.com. We are going to be talking tonight about the hysteria behind the Salem Witch Trials. No one better to talk about this subject than Frances Hill. She is going to be joining us on the show here in about 5 minutes. When the interview has concluded, we will open up the phone lines, the email bin, the text message line for your thoughts on the interview, anything that was discussed in the news segment here today, anything that is on your mind, if you've got interesting stories, whatever you want to talk about, it will be your turn to join the show when the interview has concluded. How do you join the show? Well, there's a lot of ways to do so. The easiest is to head to afterdarkradioshow.com. All of the phone numbers and emails are up and available on the front page of afterdarkradioshow.com. The studio line, if you want to give us a call, and please don't call for about an hour. Once the interview is wrapped up, we'll be taking phone calls. Studio line, 425-488-0525. That is 425-488-0525. Toll free, we pay for the call, 844-411-5411. That is 844-411-5411. Obviously, if you've got free long distance, use the studio line. If you've got a landline and you don't have free long distance, 844-411-5411. Throughout the evening, you can send us text messages. Don't call this number because nobody answers, nobody checks the voicemail. This is only for text messages. That number is 425-780-7566. That is 425-780-7566. That is for text messages. And if you want to drop me an email, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. That is B-R-Y-A-N, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. It's going to be a fun time tonight. Send your emails, your text messages, and get ready to call because we will be taking calls immediately after the interview with Francis Hill. But before that, let's head to the news.
So if we do nothing, temperatures in Alaska are projected to rise between 6 and 12 degrees by the end of the century, triggering more melting, more fires, more thawing of the permafrost.
World leaders, including Barack Obama and David Cameron, are preparing to fly to the French capital to open the COP21 negotiations, which begin on Monday. and aim to produce an international deal to reduce carbon emissions that will kick off in 2020. It won't solve climate change, but the Paris talks may come to be seen as a reset, making real gains possible. The UN process has abandoned the old approach of trying to impose on each nation a fair share of the global job of reducing greenhouse emissions and is instead allowing countries to pledge what they feel able to contribute and are prepared to defend as a reasonable contribution to the accepted global goal of limiting global warming to 2 Celsius. The bearded drifter accused of being America's latest random killer apparently made a family planning clinic that does abortions his specific target, the mayor of the town rocked by the shooting said Sunday. Robert Lewis Deere, a North Carolina native who was living in a trailer in Colorado, made statements to police Friday at the scene of the Colorado Springs clinic and in interviews that law enforcement sources described as rantings. In one statement made after the suspect was taken in for questioning, Deere said no more baby parts in reference to Planned Parenthood, two law enforcement sources with knowledge of the case told NBC News. Deere killed 3 people and shot 9 others at a Colorado Planned Parenthood office. Delegates at a crucial scientific summit this week are expected to debate a ban on the use of the controversial technique of gene editing. Hundreds of the world's leading biologists will gather in Washington to discuss the procedure in which genes are removed from or added to human embryos. The Guardian reports that some researchers say gene editing of humans could have unpredictable effects on future generations and is ethically unacceptable. They also warn that the technology could be used to create lineages of enhanced humans and want all work in the area halted until its implications are fully assessed.
The boy king Tutankhamun is perhaps the most recognizable Egyptian ruler of all time, though he only ruled Egypt for 10 years.
Egypt on Saturday said there is a 90% chance that hidden chambers will be found within King Tut's tomb, based on the preliminary results of a new exploration of the 3,300-year-old mausoleum. Researchers say the discovery of a new chamber could shine new light on one of ancient Egypt's most turbulent times, and one prominent researcher has theorized that the remains of Queen Nefertiti could be inside. This is the second find to be announced this week. On Tuesday, El Damadi said the Austrian Archaeological Institute discovered, quote, a giant fence dating back over 3,500 years at the site of another ancient capital city, Avaris. The sandstone fence is at least 500 meters long and 7 meters thick, antiquities official Mahmoud Afifi said. A technology company says it's working on a project which would allow a human's consciousness to be transferred to an artificial body after their death. And what sounds like a plot from a science fiction blockbuster, tech company Humai are working on human resurrection through artificial intelligence. They're hoping that the technology, bionics, nanotechnology, and artificial intelligence will be ready in just 3 decades. Creating an imprint of people to remain after they go, Humai is using artificial intelligence and nanotechnology to store data of conversational styles, behavioral patterns, thought processes, and information about how bodies function. This data will be coded into multiple sensor technologies, which will be built into an artificial body with the brain of a deceased human. And that's the news. We'll be back in just a moment with Frances Hill. She is the author of a number of books, including The Delusion of Satan, which is available on Amazon.com. We're going to be talking the Salem Witch Trials and so much more. Frances Hill joining us on the show here in just a moment, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Frances Hill. Going to be talking a number of topics, including A Delusion of Satan, the full story of the Salem Witch Trials. Frances, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Very fascinating book here, and I want to start at the beginning, which is essentially your decision to write it. I was very fascinated to read at the very beginning that when you first came up with the idea of writing this book, there really had not been a good historical record of what happened in the Salem witch trials. And this was in the 1990s.
Yes, I know. I was absolutely astonished. What happened was I came over, it was 1992, and my daughter persuaded me and my husband that we ought to go to Salem, because she was very interested in Arthmullus the Crucible, and she was also quite interested in Wicca. So she wanted to see the place, and I knew very little about the Salem witch trials at that point. I grew up and was educated in England, so we didn't cover them at all at school, and I really only knew about them from the Crucible. So we went to Salem. We went to the Salem Witch Museum. We saw the presentation there, and I thought the subject was absolutely fascinating. And I went to the bookshop expecting to be able to buy an account of what had happened, a good, well-researched, historically accurate, well-written account of the entire episode from start to finish. And that didn't exist. I'm not saying nothing's been written about the Salem, had been written about the Salem witch trials. You know, loads and loads had been written, but there wasn't that kind of book that I was looking for.
It's really amazing when you think about it, because this is I didn't know a whole lot until I read your book about the Salem witch trials, but I mean, it seems that everybody has heard of them. And for such an event that everyone has at least heard of the Salem witch trials, to think that there has not been that book, or there had not been at that time, is kind of mind-blowing.
It is. The closest thing to it was the book by Marion Starkey called The Devil in Massachusetts. But that was written in 1948. And it was out of date because more research had been done since then. But also it's just not a very good book, frankly. It's semi-fictional, really. It's not that historically accurate. So that definitely wasn't the book I was looking for and hoping to find. And I did find a couple of books that were very interesting, but they weren't. One was an academic book called Salem Possessed, which is really putting forward a particular theory of what may have happened. And it's extremely interesting, but it wasn't the impartial account covering everything from start to finish that I'd hoped to find. So, you know, there was this gap in the market. And it did, the idea did actually occur to me sort of quite quickly, really. This is a book I would love to write. But I hadn't written a non-fiction book before. I'd been a journalist for many, many years, and I'd published two novels, but I hadn't written a non-fiction book. But I talked about it to various people, including a publisher I knew, and they encouraged me to try and get a commission and do it, and that's what I was able to do.
When you first saw this documentary or this film or whatever it was in Salem, what was it about it that really... What was it? I mean, you mentioned that it really interested you. I mean, was there something else that you had investigated in your life and this kind of tied into it? Was it just such a fascinating story? What was it that you found so interesting?
Yes. I should say that this was actually an exhibit at the Salem Witch Museum of a really unusual sort. I've never seen anything quite like it before, and I haven't since, actually. What happens is you go into a dark room with a lot of other people. You don't know how many because you can't see anything. And you stand there for a bit, and then a voiceover starts up. And tells you that you're about to see the story of the Salem witch trials, and then suddenly a tableau of mannequin-like figures in a setting is lit up on the side of the room, and they are two little girls in a sitting room, a living room of 1692, sewing, weaving, whatever. And the voiceover starts to tell you the story. And as the story goes on, that tableau goes dark and the next one is lit up. And the whole story is told by this means. And I did find it very compelling. It was a very effective way of telling the story. But by the end of it, there were an awful lot of questions in your mind.
Sure.
It'd only been able to skim the surface, really, to give you the main points, the highlights. And it just left me incredibly curious about what it hadn't been able to say. I mean, I wanted a fuller account of what had happened. And as for whether it tied in with anything else in my life, all I can say, I think I was curious as a journalist. I'd been used to finding out about things that had happened, investigating stories, and having to fill in all the missing bits. So I suppose it appealed to that that part of me that was used to doing that. I mean, there were all these missing bits to the story. I felt, oh gosh, I'd like to, you know, find out all about this. I suppose I am. I always have been very interested in justice systems.
So that is what drew you to it, was the justice aspect of it, as opposed to the paranormal aspect or the hysteria aspect.
That's true. I hadn't even really thought about that before, but I had no doubt in my mind at any point that there was nothing paranormal going on. It seemed right from the start. I mean, I think this is something I had known about the Salem Witch Trials before I went to the Salem Witch Museum, that the alleged witches were totally innocent inhabitants of Salem Village and thereabouts who had never cast a spell in their lives or tried to bewitch anybody or do anything paranormal. They were being targeted as enemies by the people who were doing the targeting, or people that the people behind the witch hunt envied, people they wanted to bring down for one reason or another. And that was conveyed by the exhibit in the Salem Witch Museum, and that was one of the things that I was interested by, how the justice system operated, or
didn't.
Very spectacularly failed to operate, so that 20 of these people who'd been accused were actually convicted, and, well, 19 of them was hanged, and one of them was pressed to death.
Pressed?
Yes. One of them, a man called Giles Corey, refused to plead either innocent or guilty. And the old English method of dealing with people who did that, refused to plead, was to lie them down on the ground and heap stones, rocks, on top of them until they crushed their ribs and killed them. And the idea was that by having stones heaped on them, they would be forced to plead. Eventually, you know, they would gasp innocent or guilty. But that didn't happen with Giles Corey, and tradition has it that all he gasped as this was going on was more weight.
Wow.
Because, yeah, he wasn't going to plead either guilty or innocent.
Now, why was that? Why was he not going to plead one way or the other?
Well, there's two theories. One is that if he didn't plead, he wouldn't his sons would inherit his property. If he pleaded and thus became sort of entered the system, as it were, entered the justice system, his sons wouldn't inherit. He would forfeit his property. Now, that may not be the right theory, because he had actually already passed over his property to his sons. It could be that he was afraid that that wouldn't be executed properly, and he wanted to be doubly sure of his sons getting his property. But the other theory is that he was incensed with the prosecutors, with the court, with the judges. They'd already condemned his wife to die, and she was due to be hanged. And it may have been cussedness. He simply would not oblige them by pleading one way or the other. He was a very awkward sort of character, so it would be in character for him for that to be the case. But at the moment, there doesn't seem any way of actually proving either of these theories.
Going back very quickly to the museum, the display, I forget the exact term you used, but it was a display of some sort.
I used exhibit.
Exhibit, thank you. So yeah. Going back to that exhibit, would you describe it, this probably sounds like a weird question, but would you describe it as sort of lighthearted?
No.
No.
It isn't. No. It's serious. You know, it's obviously it's done to have great popular appeal. It's done very well. The little tableaus are eye-catching. They're interesting. It certainly concentrates on the highlights or the lowlights of the whole witch hunt episode, the most dramatic. The narration is done in a rather compelling way, this deep voice coming over in the darkness. So it is meant to have popular appeal, but it doesn't, it's not in any way creating comedy or lightheartedness out of something which, of course, was utterly tragic. It gives you a sense of the tragedy of it, actually, and it gives you a sense of how much suffering it caused. People who know a bit about it, but, you know, perhaps not a tremendous amount about it, tend not to realize that hundreds of people were caused terrible suffering by this. Although only 20 people, well, only, you know, it's far more than enough, but it's not a huge number of people who were actually put to death, were hanged, and in one case pressed to death as convicted witches. But there were 150 people in prison at the peak of it all, and the prison conditions were utterly horrific. And then there were all their relations who had to care for them when they were in prison. And something people tend not to know is that you had to pay prison fees. You weren't kept in prison for free. You had to pay the jailer, and you had to provide your own food. Everything you needed, you had to pay for. So all the relations of people in prison had to come to the prison, and many cases, long distances, because not all the prisoners by any means were from Salem or Salem Village. They could be from, well, Andover. There were a lot from Andover and other places all round Salem. And when they were looking after, having to come and bring food for their relations and try to look after them if they were ill and so on, they were neglecting their farms. Most of these people were farmers. And it meant that people couldn't sow their crops, they couldn't look after their animals. And another point is that a lot of the prisoners had their lands taken from them. They were supposed not to be taken until they were actually tried and convicted, but the sheriff often jumped the gun and sent the bailiffs to their estates and or their farms and simply seized their property, so that families were left impoverished. And it meant that the whole of that area, the whole of eastern Massachusetts, really, was left in as though there'd been, I say in the book, actually, as though there'd been a civil war. The whole place was wrecked. So, and this exhibit did give a sense of how much suffering there'd been, and that was one of the, you know, that was one of the things that caught my attention, because that was something I simply hadn't known. I think I'd had the impression from Arthur Miller's The Crucible, actually, that a relatively small number of people were involved in this, and I think that's, in a way, that's not fair to the play, because I think there is some dialogue which tells you that the suffering goes far, far beyond the households of John Proctor and Rebecca Nurse and a few other people, the characters involved. But you tend, as you watch the play, this isn't something that tends to, you know, catch your attention. He doesn't make a great thing of it. So that was something else I wanted to find out about, how this could have happened.
Reason I asked if it had been lighthearted was I noted that there was a minor league baseball team in Salem that called themselves the Salem Witches.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, really? This is a pretty serious deal, and you named a minor league ball team after the Salem witch trials.
Yes. Well, there has, of course, been a lot of that in Salem. The police, you know, have witches on broomsticks on the side of their cars, the Salem Police Force.
It's just amazing, because as you noted, this was a big-time, serious, negative deal. And now, a few hundred years later, it's, I don't want to say it's comedy, but they embrace it.
Yes. Well, I mean, what happened was, it's weird, as you say. I mean, it's such an irony, because this terrible tragedy 300 years ago has led to a town which rejoices, in a way, in an association, supposed association with witchcraft, and a sort of light-hearted association with witchcraft. And it makes, you know, loads of tourist dollars out of that association. And it's funny how it came about. It really came about in the 20th century, starting quite early in the 20th century, with people Well, for one thing, is that the first big book about it, which I wouldn't, when I said there wasn't a good popular account of the Salem witch trials, I wouldn't have classed this as filling that niche, because it's like a two-volume book written in the mid-19th century. And it is, it's a good read, actually, when you get into it. But not quite what I was looking for. Anyway, that was called Salem Witchcraft. And that helped kind of foster the idea that there really had been witchcraft in Salem. It never quite sort of died away, because even though after all the executions, in the years following, it was gradually admitted that they had all been miscarriages of justice, and none of these people had been witches. Nevertheless, the idea just sort of stuck that there had been witchcraft in Salem, and that the title of the book helped foster that idea. And then in the early 20th century, you started getting tourists coming to Salem who, one thing that they were interested in was the House of the Seven Gables, which has a rather remote connection to the witch trials, but it does have a connection because Nathaniel Hawthorne had based one of the characters in it on Judge Hawthorne, who was his ancestor. So people started coming there, and then the house that is called the Witch House today, there was a lot of interest in that. That's a house surviving from the time of the trials, and it looks very spooky on the outside. And then there was a firm that started, that made spoons of all things and started putting little witches on broomsticks, designs on them, to try to sell them on the back of Salem having an association with witchcraft, however false. And then later in the 20th century, this whole thing, you know, built up, this association with Wiccans starting to come to Salem because they felt, you know, there was a connection with witchcraft there that they wanted to buy into. And somebody called Laurie Cabot moved there. She's a Wiccan, a well-known Wiccan, and a very good businesswoman who started a couple of witch kitsch shops, and had a lot of followers, and then more Wiccans started coming, and then Halloween started becoming a big thing there. And it just all, you know, snowballed, so that you have that connection today as a very big deal for Salem. And Salem needed it economically, because it had had manufacturing industry until the mid, or slightly earlier, 20th century, and then that started being lost. I mean, the things it was making could be made more cheaply elsewhere, and it was in the doldrums economically by about the 1940s, 1950s. And so the tourist industry was a boon, and has remained so, although a lot of people in Salem would wish it were otherwise. It is a boon for Salem.
It's funny when you think back, as I noted earlier, I think everyone has heard of the Salem witch trials, even if they don't really know anything about it. And because it's so well known, at least to me, there was sort of that part of me that thought, man, this must have been something that went on for like 2 decades. Really, it was just over a year. It was just over a year that all of this, it was a whirlwind of hysteria. And yes. I guess we should start at the beginning. Give everybody a capsule look at how all of this hysteria began.
Right. Well, it started in the parsonage in Salem Village, which was outside Salem. It's the area that's now Danvers. And the parsonage was inhabited by the parson, who was called the Reverend Samuel Parris, and his wife, and his three children and a niece. Now, the eldest of his three children was a 9-year-old girl called Betty, and his niece was an 11-year-old girl called Abigail Williams. And they got into the habit of trying to tell their fortunes as a pastime without anyone knowing, because it wasn't something you were supposed to do. It was very much against Puritan beliefs to try to tell your fortune. It was almost like trying to conjure up spirits. But they, Puritan girls, had very boring lives, and Betty and Abigail were looking for something to spark their lives up a bit, and they'd got into the way of doing this. Now, one night, they were trying to find out who their husbands would be, and they were using a method that's called the egg and glass method. And the way it's supposed to work is that you have a glass of water, and you break an egg into it carefully, so just the white of the egg goes into the water, and then you watch to see what shape the white of the egg will settle in. And from the shape it settled in, they thought they could see what their future husband's profession would be. Now, Betty, the 9-year-old, when she did this, thought that the egg white had settled into the shape of a coffin. And that completely freaked her out. And she started having what was called a fit. And what seems to have happened is that she became hysterical. And then Abigail joined in, and they didn't come out of these fits. They weren't hysterical for a while, and then they calmed down, and you know, everything went back to normal. They went on being hysterical. The actual words used in the account is that they started climbing under chairs and under stools, and I don't remember the exact words, but they were screaming and babbling, talking incoherently so that nobody could understand what they were saying. And this went on. And then a couple of other girls locally, who presumably came to see them, came to the house, and they started behaving in this way as well, and it spread. And meanwhile, of course, nobody knew what was wrong with them, and a doctor was called. And after a bit, the doctor actually said that they must be under an evil hand. Those were his words, meaning bewitched, because he couldn't figure out what else could be wrong with them. And the first person suspected of bewitching them was the black slave in their household, who was called Tituba. And the way the story is recounted, Betty started calling out her name and saying that she was pricking and pinching her, hurting her. And then Samuel Parris, her father, started beating Tituba to make her confess. Now, he was desperate by this stage to get her to confess, because that would be, if that would show that she actually was the witch and she was bewitching them, and that would clarify the situation. And if people had started wondering what was going on here, perhaps these girls were behaving in this weird way because they were witches themselves, it would deflect that suspicion. The suspicion would be firmly on Tituba, and that would make things much better for him. There was a situation in the village where there were two factions, really, and Paris was at the centre of one faction, much hated by the other one. In other words, Paris had an awful lot of enemies. So the last thing he wanted was for something to be going on in his house that could be thought to be his fault. That, you know, if his daughter... And if his daughter and niece were thought to be in some way mad or witches themselves, this would reflect extremely badly on him. So he was very keen to get Tituba to confess. But things were moving along very quickly, and two other people were accused by the girls. One was a woman who was a beggar, who was what's called a typical witch suspect, because there was a history of people believing other people were witches in New England as in Old England, and the sorts of people who were very often accused of being witches were people in the underclass, really, sort of women who were practically outcasts and often had to beg for food. And that Sarah Good completely fitted that profile. And then the other woman called Sarah Osborne, she'd had a rather checkered history, and she was a bit mentally unstable. And she was the sort of person that people, if they were going to start looking for witches, would think of. So those two got targeted as well. And then one of Paris's close allies in the faction that he was part of went to the magistrate, John Haythorne, in Salem, to make what was called a complaint. It was actually a legal term. If you thought somebody was guilty of something, you made a complaint to the magistrate, and if the magistrate agreed you had a case, he would issue an arrest warrant. And that's what happened. John Haythorne issued arrest warrants for Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne. So the next thing that happened was that they went for what was called an examination, which was a pre-trial hearing to see if they should go to prison and then stand trial, which was, that pre-trial hearing was in the Salem Village meeting house in front of John Haythorne and two other magistrates. And then what happened there, the big thing that happened there, was that Tituba actually made a confession. And she didn't just say, "I'm guilty." She came out with this great long account of how she'd seen a little black man who'd appeared, not black in the sense of racially black, I mean, but she just meant that he had a dark look, you know, dark clothes and a dark look. And he appeared in the kitchen of the palace's house, and he told her to hurt the children, as she put it. But she went on. She said there were other... this was in answer to questions. John Haythorne had been pressing her to confess. And what seems to have happened is there came a point when she sort of snapped and decided the best way to... the best thing for her to do at this point was to say, yes, she was guilty, and then make that stack up by coming up with this great account of what had happened, which would convince people that she wasn't just saying she was guilty in order to get out of this situation where she was being pressurized in the meeting house by a very aggressive magistrate. Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne didn't make confessions, and they were sent to prison to await trial. And I think, you know, Tituba would have hoped by confessing that she wouldn't be sent to prison, but that didn't happen. She was sent to prison, not to await trial because she'd confessed, but they were just keeping her in prison. So, you know, it's there was blatant injustice right from the start of the proceedings. I mean, it turned out that anyone who confessed was kept in prison. They weren't tried, but they were kept in prison, and they were pressurized to name others.
That so essentially, you had no choice. You were either guilty, and you were in trouble, or you were innocent,
yep.
and you were in trouble. And yeah, I presume
right.
that the feeling was, okay, well, if I point the finger at somebody else, maybe that will help save me.
Yes, yes. But it's surprising how few alleged witches who were sent to prison did that. You know, you think, at least until later in the proceedings, when... The officials started using torture, and then people gave in and confessed and named others. But in the first, that seems to have started in the July. The whole thing, the whole episode started sort of end of January, beginning of February 1692. And up until July, only five people actually confessed, even though there was every reason to think it was going to go a bit easier for them if they did, and they wouldn't be examined, and then they wouldn't be tried. So they were likely to save their lives by confessing. That's certainly how it looked. But even then, of those five people, there was Tituba, who was obviously absolutely petrified, poor woman, you know, and as a slave, she was so disadvantaged in every way already, you know, so that it's very understandable why she should have reacted in the way she did in that situation. But then there were a couple of sort of very odd characters, adolescent girls, and the mother of one of them, who seems to have been a bit sort of mentally defective, and they seem to have been kind of leaned on very hard, examined over and over and over again in prison, with a view to getting them to confess. It's as though Haythorne and the others saw them as people who were, they could get to crack, if they worked on them, and they did. And then there was a girl who was seems to have been a wonderful character who she cracked when she was put down into the dungeons in Salem Prison. There was an upstairs bit that was awful, but it wasn't as bad as the dungeons. They were really dire. They threatened to put her down there, and she cracked and made a confession, but she actually retracted it about the next day, I think, because she felt so bad about having lied. And then there was another black slave who made a confession. But it was only in July when people being held in prison in who'd come from the Andover region, the witch hunt had sort of gone up to this area, Andover, in a big way, and a lot of women were rounded up there and put in various prisons roundabout, and they were actually tortured. I mean, well, they were, you know, a lot of the methods used in Guantanamo Bay, so I think you can call it torture, and being made to stand for incredibly long periods of time so that it becomes extremely painful. Sleep deprivation. They were the loud noises. There's an account from somebody called Robert Califf, who wrote an account which included these details. And they were kept awake by loud noise. He doesn't say what it was. He said by buzzings. So how these buzzings were created, we don't know. But they were kept awake for, you know, unendurable periods of time. And then there were some other, not these women, but there were some men and boys in Salem Prison who were given the tied by neck and heels treatment. It's where the person is sort of bent right over so that their heels and neck are tied together tightly. So they're in a hoop, and they're kept in that position for, they were supposed to be kept in that position for 24 hours. And certainly with some of the young men this was done to, they cracked and they started accusing. In the case of two young men, they accused their own mother. They were of witchcraft as well as others. So, you know, at that point, there were a lot of confessors because of this treatment. But yes, I was saying that's what it took. I mean, people, these people were strong and principled, and except when they were broken by these methods, except for these few cases I talked about, they wouldn't belie themselves. They weren't prepared to lie and say they were guilty and that others were guilty. They were all, well, an awful lot of them, they were all Puritans, of course, and a lot of them seemed to have been devout Puritans who really did believe that lying was a sin, certainly lying on such an important issue as this. And, you know, they'd be wrong with their God if they did that, and they might go to hell.
Looking at the, going back to the very beginning, when the doctor first said that these girls were under an evil hand.
Mm.
If he had not said that, if he had said, I don't know if they had a term for hysteria back then, but if he had determined that these girls are just repressed, they're either messing around or they're out of their minds, but this is not mm. witchcraft, this is not under an evil hand, as he said, would none of this have ever happened?
Well, I rather suspect that others might have started saying they were bewitched. I mean, it didn't have to be the doctor who first said it out loud, because I'm sure a lot of people were already thinking that. I mean, people were very quick, you know, to think that people were bewitching each other. I mean, not so much this late in the century as earlier. But there was this inheritance. I mean, it was brought from England, of a belief in witches, a widespread belief in witches. I mean, most people believed in witches. So when people started behaving in a way that to them seemed inexplicable, then they would just automatically think in terms of it possibly being witchcraft. So if the doctor had said, oh, you know, it's obviously epilepsy. Epilepsy was something they'd heard of. They had a name for. They didn't have a name for hysteria. But if he'd just, you know, had perhaps a more common sense, and he was more professional, maybe, he would have said, well, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's obviously just some sort of ailment I don't understand, and probably they just need a lot of calm and rest and separate them. If somebody had said, separate them, that could have done the trick, because each girl just by herself would probably have calmed down. But, you know, all of them together would be egging each other on, even if they weren't consciously doing it.
Sure.
You know, so unfortunately, he wasn't that sort of man, because, yes, actually, if he had been able to suggest a course of action that would have got them all to calm down, then, indeed, the whole thing might have just calmed down and never gone any further. But if he had, if there'd been no doctor on the scene, I'm sure everybody was thinking about witchcraft and somebody would have started saying it.
Yeah.
And the whole thing might have escalated the same way.
Now, another question is, this was not the first instance where people were persecuted for allegedly being witches. It had happened earlier in the century, as you noted. And why did Salem escalate to the level that it did as compared to in other places?
Mm. It was because once it had got started, there were people who saw that they could use it for their own advantage. And the first person who seems to have realized that was the father of one of the girls. He was called Thomas Putnam, and he was a close friend of and ally of Samuel Parris, the pastor, in this factional conflict that was going on in the village. And they were, his faction, Thomas Putnam and Samuel Parris, were doing rather less well than they had been, politically and economically. The other faction were beginning to do better than they were. And I it really does seem pretty much, I mean, it's there. It's you can see it, you know, there's evidence for it. That Thomas Putnam saw that he could start targeting his enemies by making the girls name them as witches. And that's what happened. I mean, one of the pieces of evidence that for that happening is that most of the complaints that I was talking about before, the legal complaints made to the magistrates who then issued arrest warrants, most of those complaints were made, if not by Thomas Putnam himself, by his close relatives and associates, like by one of his brothers or his uncle, or one of his friends that we know he had close dealings with, and it's these were all his allies. And once you get past that first stage of Tichaper, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne, who are all obvious witch suspects, the people that the complaints are against are people that Putnam and his faction would want to bring down. It's some of them are clearly enemies. Some of them are just people that he would be very likely to resent and dislike and envy. Like, as the witch hunt started to open out and more people were being accused over a wider area and beyond Salem Village, because it all started in Salem Village and then it moved out from there, one of the people who was accused was the richest merchant in Salem. And we don't know of any specific dealings that Thomas Putnam had with him, but he was the sort of person that he would have resented and loathed, because he was a very rich merchant. And Thomas Putnam was a farmer who was doing less and less well in Salem Village. Things weren't going well for farmers in Salem Village, because they only had a certain amount of land which had to be divided between all the sons. So with each generation, they were getting poorer, essentially, because each individual had less land. And the people who were doing better were the people who, they might be farmers, but they had other ways of making money as well. They had some sort of business going on, or they had links with the merchants in the town, commercial links with them. And essentially, those were the two factions. They were the faction of Thomas Putnam, Samuel Parris, and others who were farmers and nothing else. And then there was the faction of people who were branching out and doing better economically. And it was political. It wasn't just economic, because it was to do with who got elected as the selectman in Salem Village, and who made the decisions about everything the decisions had to be made about, which included what sort of security there should be for the village against possible Indian attacks, which was quite a big thing, because they lived in fear of Indian attacks all the time. I mean, it was a very real fear. And that people, you know, tend not to know that you think of Indians, Native Americans, I should say, but as in cowboys and Indians, people forget or don't know that, of course, there were Native Americans in New England, and they were the first Native Americans that the migrants from England came across, and they soon had very bad relations. And they were fine at first, and the Native Americans were very helpful, but I'm afraid the English treated them very badly, and they despised them. That was a religious thing. They thought of them. They thought of New England. They thought of the whole world, actually, as kind of owned by Satan, except the bits that the Puritans lived in. So they thought of America as the dominion of Satan, except for that bit of New England that they controlled. And so they thought of the Native Americans as agents of the devil, believers in the devil, or possibly actually devils themselves. Accordingly, they could treat the Native Americans as badly as they wished to without feeling bad about it. And they did, you know. They made truces with them, and then they tricked them and betrayed them and slaughtered them. And I'm sorry, I've lost my drift.
No. Yeah. Well, let's move forward here to how everything began to wrap up. This was, as noted, a little bit over a year, and finally at the end, not only did everything wrap up, but several years after it all wrapped up, Ann Putnam Jr. actually joined the church and apologized for everything. She said that she had been, I guess, taken by Satan, deluded by Satan, something of that nature, and she was accepted back in. And she had pointed the finger at a lot of people. I guess take us through the conclusion of this whole scenario.
Yes. Well, she was the daughter of Thomas Putnam, and she was 12 when she joined in with the hysteria. We don't know whether she was genuinely hysterical at first, but we do know that further along, she was definitely behaving she knew what she was doing, in the sense that she wasn't just being hysterical. She was turning fits on in the courtroom in order to have people convicted. And when the whole thing was over, she and her parents went on living in Salem Village. They must have been ostracized by all the people who had suffered at their hands, particularly by a family called the Nurses, because the matriarch, Rebecca Nurse, had been convicted and hanged. And that was Ann Putnam had said she was a witch. She was responsible for that. Time went by, and Ann Putnam's parents died, Thomas and his wife, and she had to look after all the other children. And when she was 26, she applied to join the church, to become a church member. And the pastor, Samuel Parris, was long gone. The new pastor agreed. But on the day that she was received into the church, he read out for her a statement that he said was written by her. Maybe he helped her with it, but he said she had written it. And she stood up as he read it out to the whole congregation, who were all seated. And she apologized. She said she wanted to be humbled and lie in the dust for having, I paraphrase, but for having brought death to so many people who were completely innocent. And especially she wanted to apologize to the Nurse family for the death of Rebecca Nurse, and she said she didn't do it with any malice in her heart, but it was all a great delusion of Satan that had caused it. Things seemed to have got easier in the village after that. The tension seemed to decrease. And it would be nice to think that that people accepted her apology. She was only 12 when it had happened. And it would be nice to think that she was, you know, received into the community and allowed to live a somewhat happier life than if they all still ostracized her. So that's how, that was the end of the, I suppose, what you might call the specifically Salem Village aspect of the whole episode, because it did go beyond Salem Village, and there's a lot that could be said about how the witch trials came to an end. There probably isn't time. I don't know. I've lost track of the time.
We are running very low on time, but...
Yeah. So maybe there's something else that you would rather end with. Or I could describe how the trials themselves came to an end.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. It was after the last hangings had taken place that the 8 people were hanged at the same time on September the 22nd. And several people spoke very movingly before they were hanged, as had happened before at previous hangings. And that seemed to, the fact that there were 8 all at once, and the tide was turning anyway against the witch trials, more and more people were not sure that they believed in the girls really knowing that other people were witches. More and more people were becoming skeptical about the whole process. And these last hangings seemed to make people feel that perhaps enough was enough. And there was so much misery and so much suffering. People were turning against it all. And at the higher echelons of society, people were beginning to speak out. People who'd probably been skeptical from the start, but hadn't dared speak out or felt that it would be useless to speak out, they wouldn't be listened to, did speak out. And Increase Massa, who was the top cleric in Boston, he wrote something called Cases of Conscience, which was arguing against the way the trials had been conducted and saying that things ought to change. And a merchant, a very rich merchant who was also an intellectual and a scientist, and an influential person in Boston, he wrote a wonderful prose work. It was just called Letter. It was his letter, and nobody knows quite who it was to, but it was obviously seen by Sir William Phipps, the governor, and William Stoughton, the chief judge. And he was arguing against the trials continuing. And the result of this and other people speaking up and just seeing what was happening for himself, I suppose, made Sir William Phipps, the governor, disband the court under which all the...
And he was the one that created it in the first place, correct?
Yes, he did, on the advice, actually on the advice of Sir William Stoughton and Samuel Sewall. But yes, he had set it up in the first place. So he now disbanded it at the end of October. And it wasn't as though everything just sort of shuddered to a halt at that point, because it hadn't been, Sir William Phipps and Stoughton and so none of them were saying at this point, we've made a huge mistake. Nobody ever said we've made a huge mistake. They just said, this court isn't the right thing to have. We will set up another court and it will deal with the rest of the alleged witches in a slightly different way. But that did bring everything to an end, because the other court that they set up didn't have the power to use what was called spectral evidence, which was the girls going into fits and saying that so-and-so and so-and-so were bewitching them. They could see them bewitching them, they could feel them bewitching. That evidence was not admissible. And as soon as trials were held without that evidence, everything fell flat, because there really wasn't any other evidence. I mean, you might have a bit of saying, oh, I think so-and-so bewitched my cows and one died. But, you know, that wasn't very convincing. And also the jurors had changed, because for reasons I won't go into, previously the jurors had all had to be members of the church. So they had to be male, they had to be property owners, but they also had to be members of the church. So they would be inclined to believe everything that the judge was saying and find everybody guilty. The new jurors didn't necessarily most of them weren't church members. So they had rather more open minds. Anyway, the result was that only three people were convicted, and then they were given reprieves by William Phipps anyway. So nobody was convicted, or the convictions anyway didn't stick under this new court. And then in May of 1693, Sir William Phipps declared an amnesty, and all the prisoners still in prison, there were quite a lot of them, I think, you know, there were still about 100 in prison, but they were all let go free. And that really was the end. Although people didn't, it took many, many, many years for people to get the convictions overturned.
2001.
The last exoneration was 2001.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Because there were people who never gave up trying to get all of them exonerated, and finally succeeded in 2001. Yeah. Mm.
Well, Frances Hill is our guest today, everybody. The book is A Delusion of Satan, the full story of the Salem witch trials. And there are a number of ways to grab it, including at Amazon.com, you can grab the Kindle version. It's only $6.99, which is the version that I got. And it is an extremely in-depth book. 268 pages, everything you ever wanted to know about the Salem witch trials. And I know you've got some other stuff that you've been working on as well, some other books, and I wanted to give you an opportunity here to plug everything you've got.
Oh, wow. Well, something I really would recommend very highly for somebody who wants to read the story of the Salem witch trials, but not hasn't necessarily got the time to read nearly 300 pages, and would like a shorter account, I would like to recommend my book called Hunting for Witches. It's you could call it a guidebook to the Salem witch trials, because it does tells you about places of interest to go to connected with the witch trials in Salem, Salem Village, now Danvers, and all the environs. But the first half of the book is an account of the witch trials, it's 70 pages instead of nearly 300, but it's it does include everything that really matters. It just doesn't go into it all in such depth and with such detail. And I'd also like to plug my book called The Salem Witch Trials Reader, which is a compilation of original documents, which are, a lot of them are great fun to read. If you get interested in the subject, to actually read the accounts written at the time of what happened, all the sources, well, not all the sources, but some of the sources I drew on myself in writing A Delusion of Satan. And then there's more to it as well. There's sections, there's a whole section on the history of witchcraft before the Salem witch trials. That's the first section, with original documents like a chunk from Malleus Maleficarum, the witchfinder's handbook of the 15th century, which is quite an interesting read. And then the second part is the actual witch hunt, and then there are three other sections. One is what historians have written, and how the ideas about what happened have changed since it happened until now. And the last section is the fiction that has come out of the Salem witch trials, from a poem by Longfellow to, you know, Arthur Miller's Crucible and various interesting things in between. Anyway, that's called The Salem Witch Trials Reader. And if I have time, I would also just mention, it's a book called Such Men Are Dangerous, which, what I did in it was to compare what happened in 1692 with what happened in 2003. It's comparing what happened, the Salem witch trials, with the invasion of Iraq. And there's some really interesting similarities. And that's something that if you're interested in either of those subjects or both, then I would really recommend it. It's a very good read, if I say so myself. And all these are on Amazon, available from Amazon. And I'm afraid Hunting for Witches is not in Kindle, unfortunately.
That's right, only paperback.
It's only paperback, yes. But the Salem Witch Trials Reader you can also get on Kindle. Not Such Men Are Dangerous, and that's actually only in hardback, so that's a bit of an ask to get someone to buy it. But it's worth it, if you're interested in those subjects. So, I've also written a novel about the witch trials called Deliverance from Evil, and that's in paperback and Kindle.
So Frances Hill is the name, and a number of books, Delusion of Satan, which is the book we talked about today, The Salem Witch Trials Reader, Hunting for Witches, which you can grab in paperback, Deliverance from Evil, which is the novel, as well as Such Men Are Dangerous, The Fanatics of 1692 and 2004, if you're interested in that tie-in. And Frances, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and best of luck with all of your books, and hopefully we can speak again soon.
Thank you. I'd very much like to. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll talk to you again in a moment. After Dark Radio, Dark Matter, Digital Network. We're back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. It is Sunday night here, November 29. We are live here every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, and we are actually live right now if you're listening live. If you're listening on a replay, we are not, in fact, live. A lot of people have been asking what's going on with the show. There have been some shorter than usual shows lately. Is the show going to continue on? And the answer is yes, the show is going to continue on. And the short answer is some days it's going to be 2 hours long live. And some days, it is not going to be 2 hours long and live. And it will largely have to do with the workload for a given day. On Sundays, there are weeks where I have to do four shows, and every show requires prep. And this show goes very, very late at night. And so certain Sundays, it is going to be much easier and, quite frankly, a lot more professional to produce a show and send it to Keith Rowland and have it play in the normal time slot. Sometimes it'll be a shorter show than usual. Sometimes it'll be 90 minutes. It'll all depend on what I've got for that particular week. If I can go live, I will. And obviously going live is a lot of fun because we can open up the phone lines and they are already ringing here. We're going to go to them in just a moment. So throw out very quickly the phone numbers. They're all up on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Our studio line is 425-488-0525. That is 425-488-0525. Toll free, you can reach us by dialing 844-411-5411. That is 844-411-5411. And if you'd like to send us a text message, if you don't feel like calling but you want to text us, don't call this line, but you can text us at 425-780-7566. Email address Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Twitter is at Brian Alvarez. And the Facebook page, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. Andrew Ludsky is the curator there, and he does a great job. And if you'd like to be a guest on the program, message him through the Facebook page, facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow, and we shall see if we can get you here on the program. Lines are ringing, so let's not waste any time. To the toll-free line, you're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian. It's Ed from Cleveland.
Yes,
Ed. Also a second-rounder in the Filthy Tom tourney at Ed Battis. Vote for me.
Very good. What a week for you.
Yes. I was wondering why the NPR style. I don't know if you caught it. I was behind on the Salem thing, the Salem interview, which was awesome. But why the NPR style now early on?
Well, the short answer is I wanted to try something new, and I'm having fun doing it. I'm working on some audio production deals, and if it works out great, I'll keep doing it. And if not, I won't. Here's the deal. So. In the old days, I would have a whole bunch of articles here, and I would just randomly read articles. And is that really exciting for people? It's to
yeah,
me.
Actually, I liked it a lot more.
Well, I do have some
the
here.
The new format kind of bores me a little bit, to be honest.
Well,
and that's not saying something coming from all. I listen to all your shows except for BNV, and it's just kind of boring. I love the site, and it's, I'm like, oh, this is my favorite show. This is the show that I actually paid for. I got my subscription so then I can always have this.
Well, I will have more articles here that I can read as well outside of the news segment, including some stuff for tonight, so fear not.
Thank you.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Got to do different things sometimes, everybody. I get bored if I do the same thing over and over and over again. Which I'm sure some of you that listen from the wrestling side are like, well, how do you watch Raw? It's hard. It's hard when you have to do the exact same thing every single day, so I like to try and find ways to make it more interesting. And I have been working on some different things, including the news at the beginning of the show. And last week we had the report from the Sasquatch Summit, which I had a lot of fun putting together. And I learned a lot of things about how to make it even better next time. Obviously, the audio for the speakers wasn't all that great, but I did the best I could. And I found some other easier ways to record. And hopefully, when I have the opportunity to go to different conferences and that sort of thing, I can do more Road Report-style deals like I did last week. And we can talk more about the Sasquatch Summit tonight if anybody has any questions, because I had a lot of fun, and it was a big success. And apparently, it's coming again in 2017. Let's go to the phones. The studio line, you're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Yes, Ryan. It's been so long.
Yes, sir. I'd like to update you on that psychic fair I went to about 3 weeks ago. I wasn't able to do that homework assignment because it would have been pretty expensive because psychic charge about $60 for each reading. But what I did do was go to...
I already forgot what the... What was the experiment? I already forgot what I asked you to do.
You want me to ask one question to each psychic, but they actually
That's
charge
right.
like about $50 or $60.
I see. So they all. So this is not like free psychic readings. They're all charging you.
Right. But what I was able to do was do group readings. And basically what they do is they remove the stress from you, from your body, by doing these meditation exercises. It's probably the most interesting one was this guy claiming to be about 10,000 years old. His name was Bill Sanda.
And there was a guy
in the crowd that also claimed that
he was 10,000 years old and his name was Bill?
Right.
Huh.
I was wondering if you've encountered anyone that claimed to be, like, from a past life, or you've had guests on your show that claim to be this old.
Well, I've yet to have anybody on the show who's claimed to be 10,000 years old. I would love to interview somebody who is 10,000 years old. I'd have a million questions. Obviously, we've talked about past lives and that sort of thing, but you're telling me that this man is not... Actually, I don't know what you're telling me. Are you telling me that he lived 10,000 years ago and has been reincarnated? Or are you telling me that he is currently 10,000 years old and has lived nonstop since the Ice Age?
Well, he's, like, died on and off, you know. He's had different souls, according to him. That he'd be frustrated when we did the group reading because he could sense that no one was putting their best foot forward in it. And he was sort of, like, yelling at the audience while he was doing, like, the meditation.
He yelled at the audience?
Well, like, when he was doing the prayer, he was saying, I can sense that there's non-believers that are, you know, not...
Doesn't take much of a psychic to predict that. Ryan, did you get a reading?
No, I did not, and I also didn't find Brian Ladd either because I found out he moved to Florida.
Why did you not get a reading? Because it was expensive?
I just don't really into the psychic thing. I was more into seeing what it was all about since it was so close to Cumberland.
I see. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you very much for the call, and maybe if you're going to go to the psychic fair again, maybe you could email me, and I'll send you $50, and you can go get a reading, and we can find out what the psychics have to say about your future. See if they say, I predict that Ryan is going to call tomorrow onto the program, or if they're better than that. Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. Got a couple of people here commenting on this whole deal. Extreme Vampire says, I'm conflicted. I like the new format lately, but also like the live two-hour show, but I will still be a listener. Well, listen, even when we were live every single solitary week, the interviews are usually pre-recorded, so there is always taped, hate to break kayfabe, as they say, but there's always some tape content here on the show. And like I said, if I can do it, I will go live as many weeks as possible, but it got very, very difficult. There were a couple of weeks there. It's the winter as well, and a couple of weeks there I was not feeling well, and then there was a week where I just had so much stuff to do. It can be very difficult, and so I thought, let's try this. We'll see how it goes, and that's the way it's going to go. So, like I said, most weeks I will be here live. I do have a baby on the way, and God only knows how that's going to change everything, but I will do the best I can. To the studio line, you're on the air. Who is this, and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian, this is Danny Hernandez. How are you, sir?
Yes, Danny. What's up?
Sure, because you had France Hill, like the Salem Witch Trials.
Oh, yeah.
Like he had a good book, you know, The Delusion of Satan. But like another good one, Old Victory, is a play, The Crucible by Arthur Miller.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically, the same thing, same type of like allegory or something to like the communisms in the 80s, like this... ruining people's lives for no reason. But I didn't catch the full interview, but I can't wait. I want to talk about, there's a show that came on Amazon Prime this week. It's called The Man in the High Castle. It's I don't know if you heard of any like news about it, but basically it's a story of alternate universe. It's like if the Nazis won World War II, like what would the world be like? So it's a pretty good show about that.
Oh, yeah.
And I definitely recommend it for sure.
Did you get a new phone, by the way?
New microphone.
Oh, it sounds way better now than before.
Oh, thanks.
So you didn't hear the beginning part of the Francis Hill interview?
No, I didn't. I missed it, unfortunately.
All right. Well, when you go back and listen to the archive, you'll be able to hear she talks a little bit about The Crucible. So,
hopefully.
Yeah, it's a good interview. It's a very good book. If you're interested in the Salem Witch Trials, I read the book, and it is a very, very good book, so check it out.
All right, thank you. Take care.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Everybody, the phone number is available at afterdarkradioshow.com. Studio line, 425-488-0525. Toll free, 844-411-5411. That is toll free. And you can send text messages to 425-780-7566. It has been a long time since we discussed this, but I would like to send a big shout out here to Paula. Sent me an email on November 1st. If you recall, we were talking to Nicholas De Leon, and we were discussing Oculus Rift and virtual reality. And I said, Nicholas, I know that I've heard the term Oculus Rift years ago, long before there was any such thing as virtual reality and Oculus Rift. And I said, do you have any idea where I would have heard this? Was there a movie? Where did this come from? He did not know. And I asked here on the air, and a lot of people were unable to answer my question. Some people had the usual, well, Brian, maybe it was an alternate timeline, like the Bernstein Bears or Bernstein Bears or whatever it was we discussed several weeks ago. Paula emailed me, and I'm 99% sure she has got the answer. She says, I know the phrase Oculus Rift from playing Metroid as a kid. I believe in the mid-90s there was a reboot, and they mentioned opening the Oculus Rift in the commercial. That was the little red eye that Samus had to blast a given number of times in order for the Rift to open to move to the next phase of the game. As a 40-year-old who grew up in the 80s and 90s, and I played video games from about 5th grade through 8th grade, and then, ironically, never again in my whole life, I played Metroid. And so I would be almost certain that is where I heard the term Oculus Rift. No alternate timeline, which actually kind of disappoints me, because it would have been pretty cool to find out that that was the answer to this mystery of the Oculus Rift. It says right here, a text message, not sure who this is from. Welcome back, Being Live, Brian, thank you. And also says here, Newsweek has a special edition magazine out all about Bigfoot, worth a $10 plus tax. I will go check that out. I'd like to see what Newsweek wrote about Bigfoot. I had so much fun last week at the Sasquatch Summit. And unfortunately, it was a Saturday night. And as many of you are well aware, my main job is radio shows and a wrestling website, wrestling and mixed martial arts. And so there was a show on Saturday night. And since the Sasquatch Summit was in Ocean Shores, which is about a 2.5-hour drive, I unfortunately had to go home before it was over. And I was able to see the presentation on the Sierra Sounds, which was really cool. But the final speaker of the day was going to be there talking about Sasquatch language. He believes that he has deciphered, how should I say this? He hasn't deciphered a language in the sense that he can't translate what is being said in the Sierra Sounds, but he believes that what Ron Moorhead recorded was a language. He's a linguist, and he did a presentation. Unfortunately, I had to miss it. But as I mentioned in the Road Report, if you heard last week's show, if you're a fan, if you love Bigfoot, you should try and find a way to go to next year's Sasquatch Summit. It will be in Washington State, so you'll have to make a vacation out of it if you live most anywhere in this country. But all of the big names were there. It was, as noted, I've been to a lot of different conferences, actual scientific conferences, and I'm not saying that this one was not scientific, because they were trying to do science. I've been to the Whale Tales, which is, they do it in Hawaii. It's basically a conference about whales, orcas, etc. And this was very much like that one. There were maybe 1,000 people that attended this year. The place was just packed. It had all these speakers, all talking about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, all of their whatever they've done in terms of investigations, in terms of research, all they're talking about, everything that they'd experienced. And there were exhibits everywhere. You could get books signed. You could buy plaster casts of Bigfoot footprints. You could buy all sorts of memorabilia. Guys like Ron Moorhead were there. Bob Gimlin was there. It was a really fun time. And I'm going to go next year. And if you get a chance, you should check it out. And one of the speakers, it was really interesting because as we talked about on the show when we interview people about Bigfoot, there are Bigfoot researchers that do not want to hear anything about how Bigfoot might be a paranormal entity. They want to believe that it's a Sasquatch. It is a hairy ape, an undiscovered North American ape. And if you try to explain that, well, you know, maybe they come here through portals, maybe they hitch a ride on a UFO, maybe they come here from another dimension. A lot of Bigfoot researchers don't want to hear that, but it's very interesting. At this year's Sasquatch Summit, there were more and more people that were beginning to come to the conclusion that maybe there is a paranormal aspect to this. And as we've talked about here on this show many times, if you're going to investigate Bigfoot, we don't know if Bigfoot exists. I know there are people who claim to have seen Bigfoot, and so they say, well, I know Bigfoot exists. But science does not know there is any such thing as Bigfoot. There may not be. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. We don't know. And so the fact of the matter is, if we don't know, if you're going to be a real researcher and scientist, you have to open your mind to any possibility. And unfortunately, for some researchers, that means you have to open your mind to the idea that maybe there is a paranormal aspect to this. And one of the speakers made a good point that he goes to a lot of UFO conventions. And he said, let me tell you something. If you are enjoying this seminar, you need to go to one of these UFO conferences. He said, not only are they a lot of fun and very entertaining, but you may be very surprised when you listen to some of these speakers at the UFO conferences who talk about their experiences and what they have seen, what they have heard, and how much it mirrors what we see and what we hear as Bigfoot researchers. So that was one of the big take-home points from this Sasquatch Summit, was this somewhat shifting belief that maybe we do have to look at other alternative scenarios as opposed to just this is an undiscovered North American ape. So I had a lot of fun. And I'll give you all the details as we move into 2017 about next year's Sasquatch Summit. It will be in late November. It will be in Ocean Shores, Washington, Quinault Beach Resort and Casino. So I recommend making your plans now because it was a lot of fun. What else do we have here? Was the Bigfoot portal guy at the convention? No, there was not. He was not there. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago. But there were guys there talking about portals. Ron Moorhead was there, and while he didn't talk about a portal, he did talk for the first time about some very, very strange things that happened in his camp when he recorded the Sierra Sounds, including one of my... I've always wanted to interview somebody about this. I've never really had the opportunity, but the reports of strange mechanical sounds coming from under the ground, which does not sound like something that you should hear around what is allegedly a North American ape. So it's very interesting. Let's see what else we've got here. Eric wants to know if Jason from British Columbia is going to call in tonight. And Jason says, I emailed him. I am in Romania doing research and cannot use the telephone. It is too risky. He says, I have new EMP information. Well, let me check my email and find out if he is, in fact, emailed me. And he has. I would tell you his email address, but you would not believe me. Jason from British Columbia. Brian, I can't call this week. I am deep in Romania doing research. I received an email from somebody with insider information that is truly terrifying. This will be the order of things that will happen to show the EMP attack is coming. Jason is doing prophecy here based on something he has been told from somebody with insider information. He says, number one, there will be an attack on Canada or Mexico. Number two, Within a week, there will be a Russian attack on our underwater internet cables, destroying, he says, America's access to the internet. Number three, within a week, there will be a Russian attack. Actually, I did that one already. Number three, the Chinese government will launch 3 nuclear weapons into the atmosphere, creating an EMP attack. 2 days after the internet goes down, this will end all modern motor vehicles and power. He says you need canned or tons of bottled water, weapons, jerky, canned goods, etc. Your neighbors will become murderous pirates who will be after your water. Trust nobody, he says. 90% of America will be dead within a year if we aren't invaded. But more likely, China and Russia will together do a mainland invasion of the U.S. after 3 months when we are at our most desperate. And the Americans will welcome our invaders since they will have food. And he says, prepare, Brian. Jason in BC, everybody. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we had a big windstorm around here. And it knocked out all the power. Now, I don't know what's going on lately, but when I first moved into this house 5 years ago, occasionally we would have windstorms and that sort of thing, and the power would go out, and, you know, 6-8 hours later, it would be back on. Well, a couple of months ago, we lost power. It happened to be a weekend that we were heading to Cannon Beach for the weekend, and my mom always keeps an eye on the house when we're gone and also feeds the cats twice a day. And so the power went out and we headed down to Cannon Beach. And I remember it was well over 24 hours before we got our power back, which was very peculiar. So a couple of days ago, we had a big windstorm, about 2 weeks ago, big windstorm, and we lost power. And again, it was, I believe, 22 hours before we got our power back. Now, I know people are going to say, Brian, live in Bothell, Washington. Come on, it's the middle of nowhere. Well, first off, I've lived in Bothell for 5 years. It's never been this bad. And number two, it's not that remote. We're 20 minutes from Seattle. We're 10 minutes from Bellevue. 10 minutes from Everett. We're not in the middle of nowhere. But it's been taking a long time to get that power back on. And the point of this is, power goes out and, man, 1 day without power, not even a full day, 22 hours without power, going stir crazy, can't do anything, can't charge anything. Went down to the local Safeway and there were just people everywhere, just trying to charge their devices, trying to get on the computer to do work. And I was lucky because there were people that didn't have power after the end of the week. So this would be very, very bad news if we had anything resembling the scenario that Jason in British Columbia is trying to draw up right here. Not good. Phone lines open. 855. I'm sorry. Let me start over again. That was the old number. Phone lines are open. The studio line, 425-488-0525. That's 425-488-0525. And toll free, 844-411-5411. These numbers are open right now if you want to give us a call, whatever is on your mind. Here for about the next 10 minutes, so give us a call. We were talking with Francis Hill, our guest tonight, about the Salem witch trials. And if you want a fun read, you can head up to Wikipedia and search for mass hysteria, which, of course, is what we were talking about with the Salem witch trials. It says here, in sociology and psychology, mass hysteria is a phenomenon that transmits collective delusions of threats, whether real or imaginary, through a population in society as a result of rumors and fear. In medicine, the term is used to describe the spontaneous manifestation of the same or similar hysterical physical symptoms by more than one person. That's a fine little definition. But what is interesting is you can read a list of all sorts of incidents of mass hysteria, all the way up through the Charlie Panic of 2015. That's this year. There's a whole bunch of them here. Let's take a look at a few of them. Prior to the Salem witch trials, in 1518, we had the Dancing Plague of 1518. The Dancing Plague was a case of dancing mania that occurred in Strasbourg, Alsace, which I guess was part of the Holy Roman Empire, in July of 1518. Numerous people took to dancing for days without rest, and over a period of about 1 month, some of the people died from heart attack, stroke, or exhaustion. Mass hysteria, a dancing plague. We've got this. Actually, we'll read the one about the Salem witch trials. Adolescent girls Abigail Williams, Betty Paris, Ann Putnam Jr., and Elizabeth Hubbard began to have fits that were described by a minister as beyond the power of epileptic fits or natural diseases to affect. The events resulted in the Salem witch trials, a series of hearings and executions of 25 citizens of Salem and nearby towns accused of using witchcraft. I've got a caller on the line to the studio line. You're on the air. What's up?
This is Extreme Vampire, Brian.
Hey, what's going on?
I thought I'd call in and share a sleep paralysis story I had just this morning.
This morning?
I was expected to join church, go to church with my girlfriend, and I was feeling under the weather, so I stayed home, and as I called her and let her know I wasn't going, I went back to sleep. As I went to sleep, the feeling, that tingly feeling around in my body came over me, and I knew exactly what it was, and it didn't freak me out because I normally have this maybe a few times, maybe a year. And I ended up thinking I was awake and seeing my girlfriend come into the house with what I thought was like maybe like chicken soup or something. And she said my name, she walked around the house, and then I got up and kind of woke up out of it, and she wasn't there, no one was there. And at the same, and I kind of like went back to sleep at the same time, but minutes later, as I drifted back to sleep, I heard a loud bang, and I woke up from that too, which is the exploding head thing you were talking about not too long ago. And it wasn't really freaky because I experienced this many times, and I thought I'd just share the story. I know it's getting close to the end of the show, and I thought I'd just share that with you.
Well, hey. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I have other stories. Like I called in before, and I had like some weird, like, Ouija board stories. And hopefully, that's why I was Twittering you, if you were going to do these two-hour shows, pre-recorded or live, because I would like to call in with those stories. I just haven't got the chance to, but anyways, whatever. Great job so far, so.
Well, listen.
Enjoy your show, so. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, listen, I want to thank you very much for the call. And as noted, I'll try and do live shows as often as possible. And please call in with your Ouija board story, because those are always a lot of fun. That was a guy, everybody, that not only had sleep paralysis, but also exploding head syndrome, which, if you have no idea what I'm talking about, it's a real thing. And you can look it up on Wikipedia, as well as all of these others. The Wurzburg case of mass hysteria, an outbreak of screaming, squirming, and trance in a nunnery led to the execution of a suspected witch. We had a Montreal incident in 1894. 60 students at a ladies' seminary suffer an outbreak of fits and seizures. The Meissen trembling disease, 1905. An estimated 237 children afflicted between October 1905 and May 1906, all the way up until today, Charlie Panic of 2015. You remember this one? Four teens in Colombia are hospitalized. Several in the Dominican Republic are considered possessed by Satan after playing the Charlie Challenge viral game. All the way up to 2015, everybody. Examples of mass hysteria. You can check it out by going to wikipedia.com and searching mass hysteria. And that is it for today, everybody. I want to thank you all for listening to the show here today. As noted, we are here every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. This is the same time slot that Art Bell is in Monday through Friday. So if you have not been listening, Art's had some great shows lately and a lot of weird things going on in Art Bell's life. So check it out Monday through Friday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are here every single Sunday night. And these shows are always available for a week afterwards as a free download at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So if you're listening right now, you can head up and grab the Linda Godfrey show from last week, which also included the road report of the Sasquatch Summit trip that I went on last week. So that is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Everything you need is up there. We're going to have a new, improved website one of these years. We are actually working on it, believe me, but it might take a while. So I want to thank everybody for listening today. I had a great time, and I want to, of course, thank Keith Rowland, our illustrious webmaster, the great Art Bell, and all of you. We'll talk to you again next time. Wrestling Observer Live is not this website. After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.
Sweet.